You're listening to the New World Order, episode 36 for season 13, for the 244th day of 2019. Hey everybody, my name is Plateau, and I am back in New Zealand. Yes, I've been away, I've been traveling to Raleigh, North Carolina, and then to San Diego for the Open Source Summit after that, and now I'm back in New Zealand. That means I'm back on my Slackware machine, which is great, because now we can continue with the power tour of all the different commands installed on your Linux computer. By default, you probably didn't even know they were there. Of course, I'm not structuring that around my Slackware box, because Slackware is, I don't know if it's, I should say famously, but it is, if you look at it, it is boldly a pretty sort of everything in the kitchen sink kind of distribution. You get the disk, or the image anyway, the ISO image, and you have everything in the distributions repository on the disk. That's it. The repository and the disk are the same. And you don't find that in other distributions like Debian or Fedora. You get a download, the ISO image, or whatever, and you know the net install image, whatever you might be installing, you get that, and it's the OS. It's the thing that you need to run, with some token applications usually installed that the distribution maintainers think ought to be installed. But they do this with a knowledge that their online repositories contain a lot more than what they've provided on the DVD or the ISO image. So Slackware does it a little bit differently. What you get is what the distribution maintainer has, and that's it. Now we're all equal. Everything beyond that is extra. That's where Slack builds and third-party repositories come into play. So anyway, all of that aside, we're going through all of the different applications or all the different commands that you find on a Linux box, like Slackware, or that you could install on your Linux box from a repository. So this is overkill in a way, but I think it's demonstrative of just how much goes on a Linux computer that a lot of us don't think of every day. And I think I've got some good examples of that today as we continue our tour through the util Linux package. We're in the user bin directory. We've almost finished the I's, and I think today we'll get through the L's. That is my anticipation, because they're not really crazy commands. They're kind of a quick things that we should be able to look at pretty quickly. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about Slackware. Let's do that. First of all, if you haven't tried Slackware, you should go to GNUWorldOrder.info, listen to episode 01 of this series. It is marked 01 because I wanted it to be sticky, as it were, at the top of the feeds, or bottom of the feeds maybe, I'm not sure, but it's 01 is the Slackware Linux special episode. It will step you through everything you need to know when trying if you want you to try Slackware. And I think that's a valuable thing, because you can try Slackware, but when you boot, you might be a little bit lost as to where to go next. So a lot of the value add in 01 is kind of that part where you have to figure out where to go next. Now, if you've never tried Linux at all, you should go to the same website, GNUWorldOrder.info, and check out episode 00. But I said let's talk about Slackware, and the reason we should talk about Slackware is because there is a new way to support Slackware, and that is on Patreon. Yeah, if you go to patreon.com/slackwarelinux, this is the confirmed actual donation homepage for Patrick Volkerding, the founder and maintainer of the Slackware Linux project. He's been doing this since 1993, and it is the longest active Linux distribution since, it's the longest living active Linux distribution. So that's kind of cool. He has very humbly a single tier system, $1 or more a month. He doesn't give you anything in return. He's not going to send you swag. He's not going to send you special prizes or make special posts. As far as I can tell, it is simply a way for you to throw money at the person behind Slackware. So if you use Slackware, or if you respect Slackware, or if you just want to see Slackware continue for whatever reason, then go to patreon.com/slackwarelinux and pledge to support Patrick Volkerding for some amount of money per month. Don't do this if you can't afford it. It's not worth it. Trust me. You should not redirect money in weird ways if you're scraping by. But if you are one of those people who, like me, has found themselves in a position where every month you can afford to give a little bit back to something, then this is not a bad thing to give to, depending on your use case, obviously. Slackware is certainly the basis for, really, for this podcast. I mean, it has been produced on Slackware pretty much nonstop. I mean, there have been exceptions because I might have been on a different laptop that day or whatever, but I mean, it's basically always been produced on Slackware. It has been, it drives Slackware itself, drives my multimedia site, slackermedia.com or .info. So it is kind of the basis for really most of what I do with computers. And for that reason, I have contributed to the Patreon account thing. Patreon itself is not a free software service. It is a service as software as a service. It is online. It is, you know, if it goes away, or if it does something stupid like starts to charge people extra money for giving money, then Patrick Volkerding will lose his platform. And I think that's probably a bridge that he will decide to cross when he comes to it. There are alternatives to Patreon. There's LiberaPay is one of them, which had a couple of problems on its own lately because of trying to find someone to send money through. It seems quite complex to deal with bank things. And LiberaPay had to kind of get over that, but as far as I know, it has gotten over that, and it's a little bit different than Patreon, but certainly the mind share of LiberaPay is not necessarily the same as Patreon, and so I imagine that probably influenced Patrick Volkerding's decision to go with Patreon, or maybe he just doesn't care that it's a software as a service that isn't free. I don't know. I don't know the man. I didn't talk to him, but I did not talk to him about Patreon. So there you go. Patreon.com/slackwarelinux. That is the authentic location. Currently, he has 372 patrons, and he's making $1,851. That's $1,851 per month, which isn't too bad. That's a pretty good amount, I think, but I don't know the situation either. I don't know where he lives. I don't know how he lives. I don't know how many people he has to support. So, and of course, there's no guarantee that this will continue. So if you can pitch in, I think that's a good idea. The other update on Slackware, I guess, is when is Slackware 15 coming out anyway? I think I even asked that some time ago on this show. I think someone had asked me, and so I said, probably not for a while. I'll give it another at least 6 months. I think that's what I said, probably. Maybe I probably said I didn't know, because I don't know, and I still don't know. And I was thinking the other day, it does kind of feel like it's time for a new Slackware. What's going on? So I went to the site. I got the changelog of Slackware is my, like, when I launch Firefox, that's what comes up, is the changelog of Slackware. So I'm pretty tuned in on what gets committed to the repository, or to the current iteration, the development copy of Slackware. But I still wasn't, I didn't, I went to the website and I looked, and I realized July 1st, 2016 is when 14.2 came out, which means that it's really only been 3 years. I mean, it's 2019 as I record this, and it's just September now. So day 244 specifically. So it's kind of funny that, I mean, it's 3 years isn't really that long of a time actually. And certainly I can't be bothered to scroll down enough to figure out when 14.1 was released, but there's activity in 2013 prior to the 14.2 announcement. So it was at least 3 years between 14.1 and 14.2. So yeah, it's not actually, this is very, very standard. The time span that we are experiencing right now between 14.2 and 15, or whatever it's going to be, 14.3, 14.4, I don't know, whatever the next one's going to be, 3 years is yeah, that's kind of, we're in the right sort of frame here. So do not despair, do not get impatient. I might do an episode sometime about switching to current, because that's always a good topic, but I'm not sure. Around this time, I feel like I do start to get tempted to switch to current, at least on some computer, not my main computer. I never run current or unstable on my main computer. That's madness. But I'm not sure. I mean, because since it is interesting sometimes, but it's current, it could break. So recently, August 29, so that was specifically, that would have been day 24. One, there were some commits to some kernel updates, a new Emacs version was upgraded, a new Vim, for whatever that's worth, and a new Thunderbird was upgraded. So there are regular commits happening. There's just not really any indication of where we are in that great big roadmap of the next release. And I think the next release will be kind of exciting in many ways, because I mean that'll be KDE 5. That'll be Slackware with KDE 5, which, you know, amazingly is not the experience of a Slackware user right now. If you're running Slackware 14.2, you're on KDE 4. So that's kind of interesting to know that people are still running KDE 4 in 2019, and I am among those people. Okay, with all the Slackware stuff out of the way, let's move on to Utilinux. Next up in Utilinux, from where we left off last time, we left off with the IPC series last time, IPCMK, RM, and S. So now we're up to something called isosize. Isosize, if I just type in isosize and then type in the path to some ISO that I happen to have on my system, here's one, Fedora-KDE Live X6430. The isosize is 18902712232. So as you can imagine, that's the expected, that's what it does. The isosize tells you the size of an ISO file, of an ISO 9660 file system. That is all it does. If you do isosize, I'll just do a control P to go previous dash dash sectors, then we get a sector count, 922984. Sector size is 2048. We can also do a dash dash divisor, and then some number. So let's do 2048 just to see what happens. That's 922984. And does that match the sector count? Yes, it does. So the div and then if we so we can change that if we go to 4094, 461717. That sounds about right. It sounds roughly half. So yeah, you can, in other words, change the way that you're interpreting the ISO 9660 image. Its own description says this command outputs the length of an ISO 9660 file system that is contained in the specified file. This file may be a normal file or a block device, such as dev HDD or dev SR0. In the absence of any options or errors, it will output the size of the file system in bytes. This can now be larger than 4 gigs. I guess yeah, at some point it used to not be true. So that's it. That's what ISOCIES does. I don't know what else to say. I mean, I've just basically overviewed the entire man page. Okay, so the next one then is line. And again, it's a pretty short man page. So it says read one line. The utility line copies one line up to a new line from standard input to standard output. It always prints at least a new line and returns an exit status of one on end of file or read error. So let's give this a go. I'll do line and then I'll hit return. And then I'll type hello world and it accurately reads the phrase hello world and it spits it back out at me. And that's it. So I could also, of course, say echo hello world and then type that into line and that would echo, or that would spit hello world back out at me. Now, I thought this was an unusual command, and I'd never heard of it, and like, I wasn't really sure why it was a thing. So I found on the in the Git repository of util Linux itself the source code for line. It's an 84 line application. Probably about I would estimate, let's say I'm just gonna throw a number out here. 20 lines of those are either comments or blank lines. It appears to be a public domain licensed little command. It is not like GPL or MIT or anything, it's public domain. And the command, according to a commit, a recent commit, a fairly recent commit, the command is deprecated. The utility is in maintenance mode, meaning we keep them in source tree for backward compatibility only. Do not waste time making this command better unless the fix is about security or other very critical issues. So we're not going to spend a whole lot more time on that one, I guess. It's kind of all we need to know. So the next one then is a logger. Enter messages into the system log. This one can be really handy. I've used this before, particularly when debugging some kind of tricky situation on the computer, or maybe when I'm testing something like a UDEV script or something wonky like that. So logger inserts messages into a system's log. By default on Slackware, the system log that it inserts messages into is /var/log/messages. That might be different on other systems. So if you try logger out on your system and it doesn't end up in /var/log/messages, then it's probably just configured to go somewhere else. First of all, you need syslog or journal D to be running in order for this to work. Otherwise, you don't have logs. Not everyone realizes that. On my workstation, my Slackware workstation, I actually don't have syslog. I don't have a logger running usually. I'll turn it on when on an as-needed basis, and I realize that that's kind of crazy talk, because you don't know that you need a log until you need it, right? That's when you needed the log, is because something happened and you wanted to find out why, and logging wasn't turned on, so I have no record of what was going on in the sort of the deep underworld of my computer, and I realize that, but I kind of know my workstation, and I've found that the logging on that really I don't really care about. And if I encounter a problem, I will restart or whatever needs to happen, start a logger, and then see if I can repeat the error. Otherwise, I just don't really happen to need it. So now on my laptop, I run a logger because that's a different situation, different use case. But for my main workstation, the one that I'm using right now, doesn't typically use syslog. So I activate that. First of all, I do sudo sh /etc/rc.d/rc.syslog start, and that starts the syslogger. So now I've got a systems log running. And that populates a couple of different files in the var log directory. Now, if I do logger hello world. Literally just that, logger space hello space world. So no quotes, no nothing, just logger space hello world. That has just inserted in it. It's kind of a silent command. It doesn't tell me a whole lot. But I'll do a cat slash var slash log slash messages, and it tells me that permission is denied. So I'll do sudo cat var log messages, spits it out, and there's my message at 13:07:29 on this host, on my local host, from user Klaatu, hello world. There we go. I've successfully inserted a message into that log. Now you can get a little bit of feedback if you want. You can do logger dash s or dash dash stderr. So that's standard error. And then you're inserting the message and you're sort of getting it repeated to you on the in your terminal. So you can kind of get instant feedback of what's getting put into the log. It doesn't really tell you a whole lot. It's just kind of, if you need that little bit of confirmation that yes, something happened, and there you go. You don't have to do your logging to your local host. You can define a separate place. So in a server room or a data center or something like that, then you're probably not logging on the same machine. But for the reasons that I've kind of explained, if something happens, then you want access to logs, whether that machine, for instance, will boot back up or not. Sending your logs off, not off-site, but off to a remote machine kind of ensures that you've got access to those logs no matter what. You can specify the destination, or rather the location of a log, by the dash dash server argument, or the dash n if you're lazy, or and the dash dash port, or dash capital P for the port to send this through. And then you can even specify the protocol that you want to use, either dash dash UDP or dash dash TCP. By default, it'll try UDP and then fail over to TCP as a second attempt. But you can sort of tell it explicitly what you want rather than making it guess if you want to. All right, so what's actually happening here is when you send a message to your log, what you're really doing is you're doing a message of the type, well, of the in the facility and a certain level. So the facility is user and the level is info. So if you go to man logger and scroll down, it talks a little bit about facilities and levels. There are different facilities. There's, for instance, user. That's kind of the obvious default one, because you are, when you're using logger as a user, that would be the obvious category into which your message would fall. It's a user message. But there are others. There's auth priv, there's cron, daemon, FTP, kern, LPR mail, news, syslog, user, UUCP, local 0 through local 7, and then security, which is deprecated. It's a synonym for auth. So those are considered, again, the facility definitions. The levels are things like emerge for emergency, alert, crit, error, ERR, warning, notice, info, debug, panic, error, and warn. So, and those last three, panic, error, and warn, are deprecated as well for emerge, error, and warning, respectively. Now, this kind of controls where your messages are sent. So if you can define where these are explicitly. So if you do logger dash dash priority, you can set with the syntax as a facility dot and then the level. So for instance, if we do user dot info and then hello GNU, And then we look at sudo cat var log messages, we see hello gnu right there at the bottom, meaning that var log messages is actually the destination file for the user facility at the level, the error, the logging level of info, I think is what we said. And that's just kind of the default. So that's the normal behavior. Now you can do other things like let's do, I don't know, mail.info, hello GNU. And now I'll do a sudo cat var log mail log. And there's a message from me to me in mail log. Okay, so the combination of facility and level is actually, there's a bunch of weird math behind it. It's something like the number of the facility category times 8 plus the number of the level name. So you can calculate how to get from the English representation of the category and level through math, if you want to just refer to it as a number. So for instance, we've got logger dash dash priority. This is kind of a cool one anyway. Space local zero dot emerge, E-M-E-R-G, and then space, and I'll just do foo space bar. Now that echoes the message to my terminal, but more importantly, in my system tray up here on the right hand corner, my desktop, I have an alert, and it says local system message service, message from syslog d at localhost at 1321 clatu foo bar. So I get a little an alert in my desktop based on the message that I've just given myself. Now I can do the same thing. I mean, that's a neat thing right there, just the fact that you can send sort of yourself system alerts through logger. So that's local zero dot emerge is the function that I just used for that. Now, if you do the fancy math that they want you to do to figure all this stuff out, then you can determine that local zero is something like, I don't know, something like 16 or so. And then the emergency level is the 0th, so that doesn't change it. So if I do priority 16, so logger dash dash priority space 16 space foo bar baz, just to make sure that we're looking at something different. Again, it kind of echoes it to my terminal, but it also pops this little message up in my system tray, and sure enough, it says local system message service, message from syslog d at localhost, 1322 foo bar baz from Klaatu. So you can convert all that stuff to numbers. You just have to count. You count down on the facility line 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and then you multiply that or something. I think you multiply it by 8, I think is the secret key for that. And then you add again, you give an index number to each level, and you add the number of that level to whatever number your facility resolved to, and then you can use the number. I don't do that. That's a little bit too much thinking for me for just a simple system logging utility. But I can imagine that if you were using this, and you were scripting it and so on, then that might actually really, really be useful to have numbers to feed your computer rather than English words. That is often a very nice convenience to have. Okay, I think that's sort of everything on Logger. There's probably some other really neat feature that I've overlooked, but I think that covers a pretty good spectrum of its probably possible or it's probable use case. Right now, I think it is definitely time to have a cup of coffee. I think you'll probably agree. And after coffee, we will take a look at look.
Yeah.
Welcome back. I hope you have coffee. I've got coffee. I took a break from being home, so I haven't. So I came back, and I'm just finishing off some coffee that I had before leaving. I've not cracked into the next bag from Carl's stash. I am looking forward to it. I did try the one of the dark roasts before I left, and it was amazing. Really, really good. I'm blanking on the name right now, but it's really, really, it was a nice bag of coffee, but it's gone. It's long gone. And now I'm just doing another sort of some dark roast that I got from from some store in a nearby town. It's funny, there's a local coffee roaster here, and I'm really eager to try out some of his coffee, but the winter in this town that I've moved to really seems to be sort of it's kind of the everyone sort of goes into hibernation. It's really interesting. I mean, now that it's turning spring now. I think today is technically the first day of spring, September 1st. And so there's a little bit more life happening. Like yesterday I went out for a walk to get a pastry, a cinnamon roll from the cafe, the Prospector Cafe, and it was delicious, by the way. And I looked around, and there were people out, like a considerable number of people, and it really sort of surprised me because I mean I've been here about a month now, and really it's sort of a quiet little town, but. But there were people. It was really surprising. I don't know if that's indicative of what the spring and summer are going to be like, or if it's just because there's activities happening in town right now. I'm not sure. Find out. Okay, so the next thing that we want to look at here is look, and that displays lines beginning with a given string. The look utility displays any lines in some file containing some string. As look performs a binary search, the lines in the file must be sorted where sort was given the name, the same options, dash D or dash F that look is invoked with. Okay, that's a bit of a mouthful, so let's just look at this. So I'm going to make a sample file here called sample.txt. And the first line, I'll just do foobar space baz. I'll do cooks space blah. Linux space slackware BSD space net. Okay, there. We've got four lines in our sample file. Now, remember the first line was foobar, right? I think. I'm sure that's correct. Yes, foobar. The second line was QUUX, then Linux, then BSD. So obviously that's not alphabetical or anything like that. So now I'm going to do look. And we're going to look for foo. So look space foo space sample dot txt, and we get nothing. It's actually, I swear that's not what happened earlier when I was testing this out. But let's go with it. The point is, well, so then we'll do look Linux space sample dot txt, and we get nothing. So the point that I'm trying to make is that maybe the man page is onto something when it tells you to sort the thing. So we'll do sort dash d sample.txt dash o for output, sample dash sort.txt. Now we should be able to do a look space foo space sample dash sort.txt, and we get foobar space baz as expected, and then look Linux sample dash sort.txt. And we get Linux space slackware, and then we should be able to even do something really late in the alphabet like QUUX, and we get QUUX blah. In other words, everything appears to be working correctly, no matter where it actually falls in the file. Now that it's been sorted. If it has not been sorted, look is pretty dumb and can't find it. Why would you use look instead of grep? Really don't know, to be honest. That's a I'm not 100% clear on the purpose of look. It seems like it's a command that requires more prep than you would imagine it would need. But I don't know, maybe there's a good reason for it. I'm not sure. For instance, I mean, we could just do look f sample-sort.txt, and that gives us foobar baz. And then I guess if we wanted to, we could add another line. So after foobar, we'll do a fudge space whatever. So now if we do a look f sample sort, we get foobar and fudge. So you get both of the lines beginning with an F. Maybe that's a feature that would be difficult to emulate. I honestly don't think it would be, but yeah, that's the look command. Hope you enjoyed that one. Was that worth a coffee break? I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. I mean, it was, coffee breaks are always worth doing. But that one's a puzzler to me as well. If you know the killer feature of look, let me know. All right, so next is LSPC, LSCPU, and this does pretty much what looking at slash proc slash CPU or whatever it is. What is it? Slash proc slash CPU info. That's what it is. Gives you, except it's a little bit more concise. So LSCPU shows you the architecture of your CPU. The CPU op modes, so 32-bit and 64-bit in my case, byte order, little endian, CPUs, 6, online CPU list, 0 through 5, threads per core, 2, cores per socket, and so on and so on. Vendor ID, CPU family, model name, all the details that you would need to know and could want to know about your CPU in one rather concise list. If you do just a cat on CPU info, you do typically get Well, you get one block per core or per CPU, depending on what your actual situation is. So you might consider that to be maybe more information, more iterations or more repetition than what you actually need. I don't know. LSCPU condenses it into a nice, easy to read screen dump, and it's kind of nice. You can modify how it displays information to some degree. So LSCPU on its own just kind of gives you that sort of nice sort of key value pair list for all the different attributes of your CPU or CPUs. You can look at an extended list, which the man page calls it display. It says display the CPU information in human readable format. If the list argument is omitted, all columns for which data is available are included in the command output. So for instance, you can do lscpu dash dash extended, and you get, I don't know exactly why this is considered human readable and the other one I guess isn't, but this is it's a table showing which CPU it's referring to, which socket, which core. It shows you some numbers that I'm not 100% sure. It looks like the L1, L2, and L3 cache, possibly, but there's some other data in there that I'm not familiar with. Whether it's online or not, the maximum megahertz, the minimum megahertz. So it gives you sort of a laundry list of all the numbers associated with your CPU. Now you can change what the table shows you or what is included in the table with a dash dash extended equals and then whatever column name you want to see. So for instance, if you just want to see the number of CPUs that you have, dash dash extended equals CPU, and then it just shows you 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you've got 6 CPU-like entities. Whether they're cores or CPUs is probably really up to you to know. You can do you can show only the offline cores or CPUs rather. You can show the online CPUs. None of this really applies to me. I don't have a system that's quite that complex in its layout. I've got a CPU in my computer. It's got 6 cores. That's what it's going to show me no matter what. But that's LSCPU. It's a relatively useful thing if you need to know more information about your CPU. And if you're really, really scrubbing for data, then it does offer some easier, you can kind of parse things differently than, for instance, again, just the output of cat proc CPU info. Okay, next in line is LSIPC. This is, as you can imagine, a way to list the IPC facilities in use on your system right now. Remember from the previous episode when we were still that when we were talking about UtilLinux, so that's episode 13. Oh, I lost it. Well, anyway, it's an episode with a big, there it is, 1331, big code block in the show notes. 1331, we were talking about the IPC list or the IPC commands. So this is the LSIPC command, and it displays the inter-process communication facilities for which the calling process has read access. So if I just do LSIPC, I get a table, a couple of different columns listing the current IPC, the inter-process communication resources, descriptions, the limit, whether they're being used, the use percentage, and so on. So for instance, resource, here's one that isn't zero. So here's SHMMNI, that's the shared memory segments. The limit is 4096. Used is 62. Use is 1.51%. Contrast that to, for instance, the SEMMNI, the number of semaphore identifiers, 32,000 is the limit. Used is 0. Use percent is 0%. And once again, you can change how that is displayed. I kind of feel like I might have already talked about this in the IPC episode, but if I didn't, now you know this is how you can get a list of the ones that have been created and that are being used and that are active. And of course, in the IPC episode, I gave some sample code on providing a way for you to actually be able to create an inter-process communication, and then you could look at that in action with LSIPC. Okay, next one in the list, LS block, LS locks, and then there's LS logins, and then we're done with the L series. So let's do LS locks first because that's the order that we encountered it. So LS locks is list local system locks. This lists information about all the currently held file locks in a Linux system. This is pretty useful. It is what it says it is. It lists the current file locks. The killer feature of this command, I guess, is that you can output it in a couple of different formats, so that's useful. Just like the other LS ones, you can kind of tell it which column to include or not include. So that's kind of nice. I'm going to do ls locks and pipe it through ls. And you'll get, again, a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 column table, it looks like. And it starts with, for instance, a command, and then the PID of the command, and then the type of file lock that we're looking at, the size, the mode, the start, the end, and the path. So for instance, here's a good one. Here's something that we can all understand, or rather that we can all not understand. So here's DHCPCD. That actually does make sense. Here's an Akonadi Balu underscore I. It's PID 1759. It's an OFDLCK. It's 0 bytes. It's in write mode. It is located in my home directory in .local share balu email contacts slash f flintlock is what the file is. So there you go. That's a file. That file is locked. It is owned by the Akonadi or the balu or the both processes. And if anything else ever tries to write to that or to remove that file, of course, it will be prevented because it's locked. You can't do that. That's useful. That's a good thing. There are lots of other examples. Lots of other examples. And quite possibly you might be surprised at how many file locks are open on your system at any given time. So it's kind of an interesting exercise to go through and take a look at what's going on your system. Now, in mind, there's a bunch of MySQL D ones, again, because of Akinatai, so the KDE desktop and the file indexing thing. Probably, honestly, just probably still overactive for the, well, it's I should say it this way. It is definitely overactive for the use that it gets from me. I don't use this sort of thing. I do not search my file system through my desktop ever. So it's just not one of those things that is a useful feature to me, at least in my current workflow. I leave it running because I keep waiting for it to crash, and it does not crash. That didn't used to be the case. In the early days of KDE, the file indexing stuff was really, really not very stable, very frustrating. It was something that typically, I feel like me and a lot of other people just turned it off summarily. And it's kind of interesting to see that it's been humming away for days and days and days now. And there's not been a problem with it, as far as I can tell. If there's been a problem, it's been silent and it hasn't bothered me about it. And it hasn't seemed to affect my system. So that's it. That's LS lock. Like I say, you can change the output format. So for instance, we could do LS lock, LS locks dash dash JSON, and we get a JSON representation of the same data. So that's obviously useful if for some reason you need all that data in a different format. And JSON is fairly, I feel like that's pretty universal. And certainly you could type that into a Python or something like that and do something fancy with it. You can do a dash dash no headings, so you don't get the header line on in your columns. You can do the dash O, or rather dash dash output, and then give it a list of things to display. So for instance, if we do ls locks piped to less again, we see that the file headings are command, pid, size, and so on. So let's just do an ls locks dash dash output, and we'll just list command, and let's just do pid just for demonstration. So that's ls locks dash dash output equals command, comma, pid. And then you get the output of just the command column and just the pid column. So you can kind of filter out things, and you can certainly do, I don't know, what was the other one? Path, I think? Yeah, path. So now we've got command, pid, and path. So, and you could do it just command path. It's flexible. That's what I'm trying to demonstrate here. So that's ls locks. And then finally, the command ls logins, which is going to display information about known users on your system. It does this by looking at the WTMP file and the WTMP log and the BTMP log, which I believe I've talked about before. The command is pretty simple. You type in ls logins and you get a list of known users on your system. It's a little table. There's UID, there's user, proc, last login, and so on. So you can limit, you can kind of filter down what you're actually looking at, because it'll show you all the user accounts on your system, including humans and also processes. So like a user account that needed to be created for Apache or for Pulse or SSHD or Nobody or ClamAV or whatever it might be. Now, if you don't want to see the extra ones, the non-human ones, then you can do lslogins-u, or I think it's --uid, probably. It's not --uid, sorry. Let's find out what that is really quick. Man lslogins, all the way down to the bottom here. Oh, --user-accs. That's an appealing long option. So ls logins dash dash user dash accs, and then you get the only the real people who can actually log in with fingers, or whatever they use to log in. So you get in this case you got root and you got klaatu. You can filter it also, or rather you can include, we'll go back here, we'll do a capital or ls logins dash dash groups, I think. Nope, dash dash group singular. No again. Dash dash subgroups. Oh man. Dash dash sup, SUPP dash groups. And that shows you the supplemental group IDs to which this user belongs. Oh, and it shows you the human readable ones too. I didn't even notice that over on the right here. So yeah, you've got all the information about these users. So you've got klaatu here, you've got the group ID of the primary group, you've got the group to which klaatu belongs, you've got supplemental groups to which klaatu belongs. That's handy. And one reason that it is very handy is because you can now filter via the groups. So for instance, if you only want to see users who belong to let's see, the wheel group, dash dash groups, wheel, now it filters that down. So again, root and klaatu. So that didn't really do all that much, I guess, but I mean, that's how I would use it. And that's how you might use it as well. Here's one. So ls logins dash dash groups floppy. And there's one user now, because root is not in the group floppy, but klaatu is. So you can kind of manipulate what you're looking at with ls logins by filtering through information that might have some meaning to you. You can also tell it to look elsewhere for the BTMP file or the WTMP file. And then finally you can, or not finally, there's the man page is pretty extensive. You can look through it and you'll get an idea of all the different things you can do. There's quite a bit. But one thing I want to highlight here is that you can look at the times that they logged in at. Now again, on a system where I'm the only user, this is not all that interesting. But you do get to see like the last login for actually I think that shows you yeah it actually shows you the last login without an option, but there isn't an option specifically for it, which is dash dash last, and that kind of makes the whole table about when they last logged in. It shows you the time and day that they logged in last. It shows you the host name that they logged into on. And the TTY, the which console they logged in through. So that's information straight out of the W command. Like if you just type in literally the letter W, you get most of that information from that. But I don't know, if you're using last list logins anyway, and you want that information in a different format, then you can get it with dash dash last or just dash capital L. That is everything for ls logins, meaning that is all of the L commands in Udo Linux in the user bin directory. Next up are the m commands. There's mcookie and mesg, and then we'll be in the ns. When does it stop? Well, actually, I think it kind of stops with user bin. So we're getting really close to the end of Udo Linux, finally, and then we'll be able to pick up with whatever's after Udo Linux. Stay tuned for that in the future. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening to the GNU World Order Ogcast. This has been klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nickball on IRC is not Flatsu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is at Klatsu, at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at Klatsu at member.fsf.org. That's Klatsu at member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
You can't judge a book by looking at its cover.